This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Now listen to this. You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo.
Today we are joined by Dr. David Keith. He is an award-winning professor of applied physics at Harvard University, where he is leading an interdisciplinary research team who is researching strategies to mitigate climate change. Hello, Dr. Keith. How are you today?
Very well. Yeah. Great to be with you.
Did you have anything to add to your intro?
No, that's just fine. I guess it's fair to say that I actually have two symmetric jobs at Harvard, both at the Kennedy School of Government, so public policy, and also engineering, so really two hats.
Well, thank you for joining us today for this interview. We will be discussing Dr. Keith's research and the climate change mitigation strategies known as geoengineering that are being investigated to deal with critical issues of global importance. And we will be discussing another issue that Dr. Keith has been involved in for some time, though for much of that time it may be fair to say that he has been an unwilling participant. That issue is the chemtrails conspiracy. Unfortunately, Dr. Keith's research team has long been a target of those who believe that there is a global effort led by some combination of secret power holders who pull the strings of government to use airplanes and sometimes satellite installations to spread or control some combination of elements, chemicals, and nanoparticulates into the air in an effort to either cause climate change or to modify local weather, or to sedate the populace, or to reduce the population, or all or some of these things, or some variation of that idea. These thoughts, when put together, is more broadly known as the chemtrails conspiracy theory, or simply chemtrails, and the people who argue it that this idea is true are chemtrailers. If it is all right with you, Dr. Keith, we are going to start with the science, and then we will get to the conversation into chemtrail land.
Sure.
Now, as I understand it, human-driven climate change is real, and many of the climate models that I investigated in my time at university are showing to be a little conservative in their predictions. The Earth's atmosphere has surpassed the 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide a decade or so ahead of a lot of the predictions, and the concentrations of that greenhouse gas is still accelerating. If current trends continue, we are realistically capable of a 6-degree rise by century's end, which would land on the catastrophic end of the consequence spectrum. Now, as climate change predictions become reality, and we work to adapt to the new state of change, mitigation strategies need to be implemented to lessen the impacts and perhaps avoid the worst-case scenarios that models have predicted. For decades, scientists have been theorizing and researching global mitigation strategies that could reduce the impacts of climate change. Dr. Keith, let's start today with a broad question. Could you please explain what geoengineering and solar engineering is, how you are researching geoengineering, and how geoengineering could be applied for climate change mitigation?
This is a broad question. Geoengineering typically means two very different things that I think are not that related to each other. So let's step back and say, what can we do to manage the risk of climate change? So the first and absolutely necessary thing is to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide, the central gas that drives climate change, eventually to zero. If you want a stable climate, we have to stop increasing the amount of CO2 in the air. And since some of it stays essentially forever, that means you have to stop putting CO2 in. And so that's often called mitigation, or it's a range of things from energy efficiency to ways that we would reduce emissions by changing the way the energy system works, say by replacing fossil fuels with solar power or wind power, nuclear power, what have you, to deliver low carbon electricity and other energy. Then it's possible we could remove CO2 from the atmosphere. That's often called carbon removal. And at least in my view, carbon removal only really makes sense as a distinct thing from cutting emissions in the world where we have already brought emissions effectively to zero, and we're talking about reducing emissions towards pre-industrial, if that's what humanity wanted to do. That's what I would advocate. Third, it's possible to deliberately intervene in the energy balance of the Earth in what's often called solar geoengineering. It goes by different names as well. And that would be by, say, making the Earth a little bit more reflective, by putting aerosols in the stratosphere is one common idea. And that would reduce some of the impacts of accumulated CO2 in the atmosphere, but not all of them. And it would introduce its own new risks and uncertainties. So that's the topic I think of most realistically is geoengineering or solar geoengineering. And then, of course, the last big way that we respond to climate change is by adaptation, by deliberately finding ways to reduce the harm that climate change causes to humans and ecosystems.
Could you explain then what you're specifically working on in terms of solar geoengineering?
So we work on a big range of things at, in my group and other related research groups at Harvard, ranging from climate models to try and understand how well different potential ideas for how to do this might work. That is how effective they would be in reducing actual risks we care about, like say the risk of big storms, hurricanes, or typhoons, for example, that are so damaging to some of the people in the tropics, or extreme heat, and also to understand what the risks are. For example, if you're introducing a new aerosol into the atmosphere, that's effectively a new air pollutant, and you have to think really hard about what the risks would be to people and ecosystems of doing that. So there's a whole bunch of work that's kind of physical climate science, essentially applying existing climate models to try and understand how these ideas might work, how effective they would be, how risky they would be. Then there's work understanding the individual atmospheric processes that are kind of the things that are inside the models, because these models aren't perfect. And so that can mean experiments. There are no significant scale outdoor experiments in geoengineering that have been performed. But for example, we have a laboratory experiment that's testing some particular reactions that are important in the stratosphere to help us do a better job of predicting the risks and efficacy of some of these schemes. Then we do a lot of work on the governance of these technologies, trying to understand how they might fit into existing international law or new international laws. What the positions of different states might be and how they might interact, how they fit into conceptions of environmental justice, and what people think of them, what the public thinks of these ideas in different ways. So we do a range of things, from work on the physical science side to the technology to the sort of assessment side, and then to the governance and public perception.
So you mentioned that none of these experiments are really happening outside of the laboratory. How could such research start to happen outside of a lab setting? Like what steps would be necessary?
So it's a little, to answer that, you got to define what the research is, because this is really a matter of intent, not actions necessarily. Mm. So to some extent, there's been outdoor perturbative experiments for atmospheric science on and off for a long time. So there have been experiments trying to understand say the way pollutants mix in urban environments by deliberately releasing materials. There have been experiments. There was an experiment called EPEACE that I think you could argue was a geoengineering experiment performed off the coast of California to look at the impact of some kinds of fine aerosols and creating kind of low clouds. I can tell you about the experiments that we're proposing, but exactly how these things end up happening is hard to judge. So we're focused most on schemes that could work in the stratosphere. And so some of those methods have a potential to damage the ozone layer. And we need to understand better how much that's true, and also whether we could find ways to avoid that or even repair the ozone layer. And so we've been developing experiments. And by developing, I mean kind of planning, but not executing experiments that would allow us to make precise measurements of some perturbation that we introduced into a little bit of air in the stratosphere. And to give you a sense of the scale, we would do this from a stratospheric balloon, and the broader group I'm part of has a fair experience of making stratospheric chemical measurements. We're one of the groups that has helped to understand the cause of the ozone hole. And so we would use some of the same instruments and techniques we've done to do that over many decades. And so we might try and make a small cloud of perturbed air from a propeller on a stratospheric balloon. We'd be talking about releasing a few hundred grams of material. So this is equivalent in terms of its impact on the atmosphere of sort of a minute's flight of a commercial aircraft that you might fly across the Atlantic on. So I don't think anybody, even the strongest opponents, would actually argue that that experiment itself was physically dangerous. I mean, people argue that it's bad to do these things because they are kind of pointing the world in a direction that these people think it shouldn't be pointed, or that it opens up a door in some way that's dangerous. But I think the experiments themselves are really at a tiny scale, so I think it's hard to see them as dangerous. The question simply is, how they would get funded, how they would get monitored, and when they would get done.
Now, you mentioned risks. What kind of risks? Like, could we end up with a blacked out sky like in the Matrix, or are we talking
risk from experiments, or risk from experiments, or risk from implementing geoengineering?
I guess those would be two different, very different questions. Let's start with the experiments. Is there, you know, if you're just doing these small scale experiments, you mentioned the risk would be similar, or the impact would be similar to, you know, minutes flight of a airliner flying in the lower atmosphere. How about if it was scaled up? What have you been looking at in terms of risks?
Well, I don't see a lot of reason to scale up experiments. If you want to understand the interaction of different things in the atmosphere, it's intrinsically local. You want to understand how one chemical affects another. And so from a scientific point of view, there's not a lot of reason to make those experiments bigger. There's a lot of reason to do various different experiments in different places. But there's not a lot of reason, at least that I see, for the things we're thinking about to make the experiments bigger. So I think if you're asking, is there some catastrophic outcome from those experiments? I think you can really say with high confidence the answer is no. And that's part of the reason is, of course, we're talking about introducing very common chemicals, not introducing biological materials. So if you do an experiment, say, with genetic engineered materials or with virus or something, there's always some potential risk that even a tiny experiment done at a laboratory scale could have global consequences, right? If I was experimenting with smallpox, obviously I could have a disastrous impact. But as I sometimes say in talks, sulfur doesn't have sex. So if you put 100 grams of sulfur in the stratosphere, which is about the amount that's released by an aircraft in a minute's flight, it's, I think, really inconceivable to imagine there's some awful impact directly from that.
Fair enough. Sulfur doesn't have sex. I don't think I actually have come across that quote before, but I like that. It's a good way of thinking of it.
I think it gets at the fact that these things are that when we think about some of the, I mean, one of the things people naturally think about when they think about ways that manipulating nature to try and fix something has gone wrong is we often think about examples where people have introduced one species to control another. And I think it's really valid to think about ways in which these control strategies have gone wrong, but it's important to think about the fact that it's quite, I think there's a fundamental difference between biological organisms which self-reproduce. So once you put mongoose on Hawaii to control the rats, if you've got a boy and a girl mongoose, you can't control the results necessarily. And yet it's in some ways fundamentally different to talk about just releasing a chemical element like sulfur or calcium or something, which is common in the atmosphere anyway. In that case, there's no sort of possibility of a runaway reaction.
Right. With the risks, what are some of the rewards of implementing this technology if it were to be implemented at a larger scale?
I mean, why care? Why are we spending any time on this? Because there's a fair amount of evidence from real basic science, from the entire suite of modern climate models, that suggest that doing some versions of solar geoengineering could dramatically reduce climate risks over this century and reduce them for some of the most vulnerable people in the world. So that's the reason I'm interested in vulnerable ecosystems. So to give you some sense of that, one of the most obvious risks of climate change actually is simply that high temperatures kill people and make them less productive. And you can see some examples of that in the horrifying deaths from heat in the Indian subcontinent in the last year. And there's now really strong evidence that high temperatures actually interfere with people's productivity, people's learning in schools, for example, as well as killing people. And so if solar geoengineering could significantly reduce peak temperatures that would be caused by climate change over the century, there's a direct human benefit from that. Another example would be sea level rise. Another example would be the impact of global warming on reducing agricultural productivity. So at least in most models that have been done of the impacts of solar geoengineering on agriculture, you see increased agricultural productivity in a world with a certain amount of CO2 and geoengineering than in a world without. So the basic reason to care about this is it looks like it might be able to significantly reduce the risks of climate change that we're so concerned about.
Yeah. what scale would you have to undertake solar geoengineering project to have a worldwide impact? Would it be possible to create localized changes with smaller implementations of stratospheric spraying of aerosols?
No, or close to no. So I think that one of the good or bad things, depending how you look at it, of stratospheric aerosols is they want to be maybe not global, but at least sort of hemispheric. They don't want to be local. They naturally spread. I mostly think that's a good thing. I think that you don't want people doing a lot of local control of the sort of what's called the radiative forcing climate, because we only live on one planet. And I mean, I guess if people could independently control the climate in each place and there was no interaction, then that would be easy politically. Each community could set the climate where they want, but that's nonsense. The world is interconnected by flows of heat and moisture, and there's only one climate in the end. And I think if this is going to be done, I think it makes the most sense to do it in a way that's pretty geographically even, because that has the most chance to reduce climate changes in an even-handed way.
Would it be possible to do this at a localized scale? Like with smaller implementations, or just like not, it's not worth it, but is it possible?
Well, so there's so with stratospheric aerosols, I think the answer is pretty close to no. There are some odd variants that might sort of, I mean, it depends what you mean by local.
Sure.
There are ideas for making certain kinds of marine clouds whiter, but with sea salt sprays. And that could be done in an area, you know, that plausibly, you know, it was over sort of a few thousand square kilometers or something, or tens of thousands. So, you know, sort of an area like a patch off the coast of California or something to modify more local or what you call regional climates at the level of, say, something that's a few thousand kilometers on a side. I mean, that might be possible.
Right. Okay. Yeah, just that might come up a little bit later as we get into the next part of the discussion. Like, are we in the scenario that global scale geoengineering programs need to be implemented? Like, in your book, A Case for Climate Engineering, you argue we must consider geoengineering seriously. Are we at that point?
Well, those are two really different questions. I think we're at the point where thinking about it seriously makes sense.
Sure.
And most of all, a serious research program makes sense. So I think there's enough evidence that it could be useful in reducing risks that it makes sense to have a broad, you know, open access, multinational research program. And then based on that research program in a decade or something, one could talk more seriously about decisions around whether implementation makes sense. I don't think it makes sense to talk about implementation today.
If we did implement large-scale stratospheric spraying, would these ideas be effective to effectively mitigate climate change? Or do we still need to put in other measures, with geoengineering being only one of the tools? And are there other promising geoengineering research projects which could also be implemented?
Well, it's a lot of questions, but I'd say the most important thing to say by far is that nothing we know about solar geoengineering means that it solves all the problems. So for certain, it only makes sense if you do it in combination with cutting emissions. So the most important single thing to do about climate risk is to cut emissions of the warming chemicals, principally carbon dioxide, eventually to zero. So I don't think anybody who's serious about this is thinking about geoengineering as a kind of substitute so we don't have to cut emissions. The question is, might we want to, as well as cutting emissions, also do some solar geoengineering to further reduce the risks? Because the problem, given the long lifetime of carbon in the atmosphere, is even if we cut emissions to zero, we actually don't make the risk go away. So that really is by far, if there's anything that people need to hear, it's that. So it's a natural thing to say is, why the heck would we mess with this crazy idea of putting sulfates in the stratosphere or some other geoengineering scheme, which seems like a kind of a backdoor fix when we really just know what we should do, which is cut emissions.
Right. But we
have reason that, well, but we will. But that's not the answer I was going to give.
Okay.
The reason that answer I gave isn't convincing is that even when you cut emissions to zero, you don't make the problem go away. The problem comes from the cumulative emissions over human history. And so even if we brought emissions to zero, say, in 20 years under, something, pick Canadian stuff, something much more aggressive than the LEAP manifesto could do globally, you still don't eliminate the risk. Indeed, it still might be warmer in 2100 than it is today because of carbon cycle feedbacks. So you might want to have the ability to further reduce the risks using something like solar geoengineering.
You have been listening to a discussion with Dr. David Keith, a Harvard-based professor and a leading scientist looking into climate change mitigation. This is Dan Keller for AOL Radio on CKMS 100.3 FM in Waterloo Region, soundfm.ca on the web. And we will now get to the second part of the interview with two quick questions on climate change policy and a bit of a discussion around the chemtrails conspiracy theory.
Now, moving to policy quickly. Here in Canada, we are still approving tar sands and fracked oil pipelines, still expanding natural gas infrastructure. We seem very much on the business as usual approach when it comes to not fighting climate change. Why has the Canadian government and many governments worldwide been so slow to react to climate change?
Well, first of all, I think it's all governments worldwide. The basic scientific knowledge that there's a problem if we keep emitting CO2 in the atmosphere is really old. From the 60s, and the first, it was discussed at the Stockholm meeting, the first big global environment, the development meeting in 1972. And so I think, two things to say. The world actually has done an amazing job solving lots of other environmental problems since that date.
Right.
So if you think about DET or lead in gasoline or the global ozone layer problem, lots of different environmental problems, including real substantial improvements in air and water quality, have happened in lots of the world, more in the rich world than the poor, but even in lots of poorer places. But we made almost no progress at all on climate. And so the question you got to ask is, why is it different?
Right.
And I think a thing that climate activists often say is they say, well, the reason we haven't made progress on climate is because of all the industry opposition. And I think that industry opposition is real, of course. Industry fights to try and protect itself and sometimes fights in ugly ways. But that was true for all the other things I brought up as well.
Hmm.
And so that cannot be a convincing, complete explanation for why we haven't. And I think if you're going to solve the problem, you've got to face what the problem is head on. And that's not to let industry off the hook. It's certainly true that people in some of the fossil fuel industry have deliberately manipulated the political process and lied to try and reduce efforts to cut emissions. But that is not the whole problem, and I don't even think it's that much of the problem.
Hmm.
The big reason why it's hard to cut emissions is, and it's going to sound very academic, but it's the problem that it's a commons problem, a global public good problem. The problem is that money that we spend today to cut emissions, the benefits of that are shared globally and they're in the far future. And that makes it in some fundamental way hard to get a deal in a world that's governed by a whole lot of little countries.
So it's not so much of a climate change denial problem with governments at this point. It's more of a money issue in terms of like how selling the idea of taking this on and spending a lot of common resources to tackle this problem?
I mean, there's complicated politics around what's called climate denial. I don't think very much of the kind of power elite that make decisions in this country or others really disbelieve that there is some kind of core scientific problem of accumulating CO2 causing climate change. I think some people who will make claims about climate denial are really, for other political reasons, don't want to see action, and they feel that's the most effective thing for them to say.
Okay.
There are certainly some people who just don't believe it, but I don't think that's a very big number.
Sure. All right, now that kind of covers our the part of the discussion I wanted to have on climate change specifically. Now we're going to get into the other topic for this interview, the chemtrails conspiracy and chemtrailers. Over the past few weeks, I've been spending a bit of time reacquainting myself with the world of the chemtrails conspiracy theory after concluding the whole thing was nonsense nearly a decade ago. The only peer-reviewed work I could find while researching for actual evidence of chemtrails were studies that investigated the people who believed in chemtrail theory. I could not find any scientific experiments which proved we were being sprayed with any of the elements or chemicals that chemtrails theory argues, nor could I find any congruent ideas about who was organizing this conspiracy and how it was all being undertaken. One academic paper I did find concluded chemtrails was a group-mediated delusional theory developed online in insular chat boards. Now, as someone who has engaged with chemtrailers over the years, can you explain what you understand chemtrails to be?
Sort of hard to do. That's really the job of somebody who believes in them. In my experience talking with people who seem to believe this, there's a big range of beliefs. Some of them seem to believe that actually something more or less like the ideas we're talking about of solar geoengineering is actually happening, but secretly. Others believe that it's some kind of deliberate spraying of toxic chemicals for everything from mind control to mass extermination. I mean, people say really strange things.
Yeah. It is a pretty broad range of ideas that have come out, and no like congruent themes or ideas that run through them all. Now, on the cover of your 2013 book, A Case for Climate Engineering, you have a picture of a body of water with sun bursting through a pocket of heavy cloud cover. I'm sure this is being used as evidence you plan to change the clouds. How are supposed chemtrails different from cloud seeding technologies, and how do both of these things differ from the research you are doing?
So again, you sort of need to have somebody who believes it to ask questions. So I'm not sure how to unpack a question I can answer there. So we're working on the possibility that we might want to put reflective aerosols in the stratosphere. The people reporting chemtrails tend to talk about release of, they tend to point to evidence from normal aircraft contrails. Mm-hmm. Those are condensation trails that come when aircraft goes through an area of higher relative humidity, and they will trigger sometimes very long persistent contrails that will make very odd shapes, and some of them will last for days. And that's actually been well understood for decades, and there's pictures many, many decades old of these persistent contrails. And so that's happening at a very different altitude in the atmosphere than we're talking about. You wouldn't make a visible trail from the ideas we're discussing in any case. Sure. But I want to step back from the sort of specifics. Why don't I believe it's happening? So first of all, I can't prove it's not happening. Sort of proving absence is almost impossible. Mm. But governments do things that are secret, but typically do things when there's at least some kind of plausible, coherent reason inside the government why they do it. So sometimes governments will have secrets to protect themselves. So they'll, lie to cover up some earlier thing they did that's wrong. That's pretty common, I think. Or governments will have secrets in operational nature that they, want to execute some military maneuver or do some, deal with some criminal organization, and they need to be secret about it. And sometimes they overreach in their secrets. But this is a totally different thing. The claim here is that there's a very large-scale operation that would, if it really existed the way the chemtrailers are saying, and all these big fraction of contrails were some special thing, you need enormous amounts of material with thousands of aircraft modified, and that would require presumably tens of thousands of people, a huge supply chain. How would all those people be silent? It defies imagination.
Well, the last time I confronted or tried to have a discussion on with a chemtrailer, they asked, well, who controls the chemtrails? Who controls when to spray? Because sometimes they say, when they don't spray, it doesn't rain, but they sprayed a couple days ago and now it's raining. And I'm like, well, who makes those calls? The response I got was some combination of George Soros and David Rockefeller. And obviously, it's obviously not a very good argument that, well, they didn't spray and it's not raining, but now it's raining because they sprayed a couple days ago. Obviously, that's a pretty weak point with their arguments. But so, what about the so-called proof that chemtrailers present? Pictures, the so-called studies that they always relate to or talk about. I recently watched a nearly 2-hour video from 2011 with you and two colleagues sitting in a room with in Calgary with 10 individuals who were trying to convince you that chemtrails were a real thing, causing a whole host of problems. It was a painful watch, but it was an interesting experience. In that video, you told the group, if this chemtrails conspiracy theory exists, you would stop everything else and devote yourself to the issue. You then told them you had needed some real evidence before you could agree that the conspiracy exists. Now, since you're still researching climate change mitigation strategies, I'm assuming you never got that evidence, or did you receive anything from those folks?
I don't think I received anything from that group. I've got a few occasional emails that claim to be evidence, but it always sort of goes nowhere. So I got an email that had a picture that showed a vapor or a trail you could see coming from a part of an aircraft that wasn't the engine, that I'm pretty certain is a normal fuel dump. Airplanes have to dump fuel if they're too heavy. And, you know, I responded pointing that out and I didn't get a response back. Recently, I've had an email that, or no, I guess a Twitter that has a chemical analysis that has, I forget what, but some set of chemicals that they said I'd said would be put in the stratosphere. Aluminum mm-hmm. was one of them. But it was sort of, it wasn't anything remotely like what you need for real evidence. It didn't say anything about where it was collected or what the collection measurement was or what the background measurement was. And of course, aluminum is actually, or oxidized aluminum, alumina, is one of the most common elements in the Earth's crust. And so it's in water pretty much everywhere. So it wasn't even remotely serious evidence.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the contrailscience.com, a webpage that was set up, you know, more than a decade ago, that's what they do. They take, you know, the evidence, the so-called evidence that's presented by chemtrailers and just kind of pick it apart. And a lot of the, you know, none of the studies that they show have, or that they bring up, they don't really follow the scientific method, I guess, in terms of doing this research properly. We got into, like, you know, the chemtrail series not really having any validity. The pictures, the studies that they have, the scale of the proposed conspiracy would be massive, as you pointed out, with all the materials, all the engineering, all the you know, storage of chemicals, all that. Now, you also told those in the video that you and your colleagues have received death threats over the issue, and you took them to the task of taking responsibility about the things that they say, along with the potential consequences. On reading comment section of the video, as well as on Facebook and Twitter feeds about chemtrails, the vitriol spewed your way continues. Are you still receiving threatening emails and phone calls?
I receive awful ones. I haven't had one that... I mean, some of them... Yes. I haven't received one that we've had to call the police for at least a year.
So you have taken these threats seriously?
Yes.
Does this usually take place digitally, or are you ever confronted in person?
I've certainly talked with people in person, but actually in person they tend to be more polite. I think it's easier for people to be angry at faceless things over the internet, and when they're confronted by a real human being who is presumably has sort of the same concerns that they do, they tend not to be so angry. So I have several times met with people who are carrying, you know, protest flags and stuff for chemtrails, but when you actually talk with them, they, at least in my experience, I haven't encountered really, really severe anger.
So it does seem to just filter out online then. Now, also in that video, and I'm sure the video is kind of reflective of other experiences you've had and other discussions you've had with people within the chemtrail conspiracy world. In that video, you challenge the chemtrailers on their theories and you explain the actual science, the geopolitics, the on the ground realities at play. However, your logic seemingly did not impress. It's now 5 years later from that video, and the chemtrailers are still using the same arguments that they were using as evidence for chemtrails. Now, in my interactions, I've come across a lot of intersections between chemtrails believers, climate change deniers, anti-vaxxers, New World Order and Agenda 21 types, and those who express white nationalist and anti-immigrant opinions. Have you noticed any anti-science, anti-intellectual, or anti-academic, or bigoted themes in your interactions with chemtrailers?
I got a very anti-Semitic email. I mean, I guess sort of by definition, the whole thing is sort of anti-science, or not by definition, but in the way people approach it doesn't seem to be kind of motivated by the ideals I have for science. I mean, I'm not, this may not be that useful a conversation. I'm not going to speculate about, I mean, precisely because I do believe in science, I've only have a limited sample of who I happen to talk to. I don't feel comfortable saying things about the chemtrail world in general. I can respond to things I hear. I mean, we had an early public opinion poll that looked at Canada, US, and UK, and that's a publication with Ashley Mercer, and we asked a question to try and identify the fraction of people who believed in chemtrails. We didn't use the word, but we said something like, you know, the government is deliberately trying to do X secretly, and it was a surprisingly high number, quite a few percent.
Now, whenever you appear in the news or at a conference speaking about geoengineering, as you recently were at Oxford, chemtrailers use that to indicate that all of their theories are correct and that all the things you say are doing are true. Why do people find it easier to believe in this in the ridiculously complex and unprovable conspiracy thoughts rather than the slightly less complex climate change science and the mitigation science which you're putting forward? Is this a larger problem with science literacy in general?
Well, again, I don't think I'm really the right person to ask those questions of. I don't think I have a much deeper insight into why people believe this stuff. I mean, I would say there's a broad climate of denialism or of, you know, of sort of subsets of society that believe things that most of us think are nonsense. So, I mean, there's a surprising large number of people who think that 9/11 was an inside job and the towers didn't actually, you know, didn't fall down because airplanes flew into them. And even I actually have got emails about that associated with chemtrails, so that they link up. And there's, of course, the vaccine thing. And there's people who don't believe in climate change. You know, lots of these things are 10, 20% of the population. They're big numbers.
Yeah.
So why that is beyond me. I mean, I think one answer would be that people were over credulous about what scientific elites would say, perhaps in the 50s, and then this is a kind of aftermath of some of the rebellion against elite power in the 60s. And I think the rebellion against elite power is healthy, but I think the I believe that in a kind of old-fashioned liberal idea that there really are some facts that we can get to. But I'm afraid I just don't think I'm the right person to ask about this.
You spend time talking about the issue, and you spent, you know, 2 hours with that conspiracy group in Calgary. Engagement, obviously. You think that is a worthwhile tool to change people's minds?
Sure, but I'm not sure I have that much more to say in this interview, Carlos.
And the final question I had, as chemtrailers are increasingly showing up at rallies, public consultations, city hall, and radio stations, do you have any advice for dealing with such folks as you have a history of doing so? Like,
I think it's the advice is simple: be respectful, listen to what people actually have to say, try and ask them questions so they get a chance to state their position, and I think people respond well when they feel that their concerns are being taken seriously. And I have had actually, while I've had real hate mail, I've also had email exchanges with people who evidently changed their mind. And I've had conversations with people who changed their mind, who said, well, maybe this isn't true, or yeah, you maybe rethink this. So I think that in the end, all that you have here is sort of individual human interactions. And I think you need to find a way to kind of call people on stuff and ask them why they're doing what they're doing and why they believe stuff, what their basis is for.
Right. Right on. Well, is there anything you'd like to add to our discussion today?
No, that's great. Thanks a lot for doing it.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time today and for discussing this important these important issues. Have a great day.
And that concludes our interview with Dr. David Keith. He's a prominent professor at Harvard University researching climate change mitigation strategies. For more AWOL Radio, check us every Friday afternoon on CKMS 100.3 FM in Waterloo Region, soundfm.ca on the web, and check out all our past podcasts up on rabble.ca.